Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The abstract paintings of the American artist Agnes Martin, 1912 to 2004, are often discussed in terms that approach religious devotion. They have been called a form of prayer, a revelation, even purism in excelsis. Martin's carefully crafted works of art are designed to engender great floods of emotion in viewers. But what happens when we strip the rhetoric that surrounds Martin's paintings away and consider the art, the thousands of aesthetic choices that the artist made in her pursuit of a form of abstraction that was, to use her term, completely non-objective? In this lecture, held on March 19, 2017, at the National Gallery of Art, Christina Rosenberger charts Martin's artistic evolution through careful attention to her form and facture, arguing that Martin's early work, from 1947 to 1961, defines the terms for all of her subsequent artistic production.
Before I begin, I wanted to thank Harry. When I worked with Harry at Harvard, I announced, with all the obliviousness of youth, that I wanted to write on grids. And at this point, I had no idea about Rosalind Krauss's seminal essay on the grid, which Harry gently suggested that maybe I should read. And so I did that. But before Harry let me go, we were having this conversation in the bowels of the basement of the Fogg Art Museum. He said, "What art are you interested in, Christina? What makes you excited? What are you interested in looking at? What were the questions for you?" And that was really a key question for me, that it wasn't about a concept, but it was about the work of art. And when I said that I loved an Agnes Martin drawing in the Fogg's collection, Harry asked another good question. What aspect of Martin's work hasn't been studied very much? Where is there a need for scholarship? So it's a very short way of saying why I'm here today. So thank you, Harry. I don't know if you remember the conversation, but it was very important to me. I also owe a great debt to Lynn Cook, who's here today. She's a curator in the Department of Modern and Contemporary Art with Harry. And Lynn, as many of you may know, curated a really extraordinarily beautiful multi-year retrospective of Martin's work at Diabeacon. And she generously allowed me to come and examine the paintings over a period of many months. And this was a great logistical expense for Dia, because I came and, you know, looked at the versos of the painting, and I looked very closely at the front of the paintings, and it was really an extraordinary opportunity. And that sustained observation, often with Lynn by my side, is really what taught me how to look at Agnes Martin's paintings. Lynn has written with rigor and great insight into Martin's work. And she had a publication in 2011, a book of an edited volume of essays on Agnes Martin. And that's really what inaugurated the recent surge of interest in Agnes Martin. By bringing together essays by a host of art historians, Lynn really charted the possibilities for further scholarship on Martin's work. And this laid the groundwork for the exhibition, the big international traveling retrospective of Martin's work, which just closed at the Guggenheim in January. So it's my great privilege to be here today with Harry, but also with Lynn, and talking about Agnes Martin and her company. I saw my first Agnes Martin painting in the early 1970s at the home of a collector of contemporary art. Critic Benita Eisler wrote on the occasion of the artist Agnes Martin's 1992-1993 retrospective at the Whitney Museum of American Art. "Night C," Eisler recalled, "hung at the top of a staircase, invisible until you arrived on the landing. Then it hit you with the full force of revelation, a shimmering golden grid that seemed to hover above a velvety blue ground." Created in 1963, Night C is one of Martin's great paintings. Measuring 72 inches and nearly square, the painting is executed on a linen support that's been partially coated with a white ground. Martin then applied a local priming layer of white paint, over which she created nearly 3,000 rectangles of lapis-lazuli marks in oil paint. The blue marks are covered with a second set of almost identical marks, another 3,000, in sea green oil paint. Martin delineated a grid by scoring the canvas, over which she applied gold leaf. Finally, she defined the edges of the painting with a border of lightly coated canvas and tiny registration marks in yellow crayon are visible. Those are the little dots you see on the left. As with so many of Martin's paintings, the parts do not accurately describe the whole. And as you can see, the gold has faded and the painting suffers in reproduction. But at the time of creation, Martin thoroughly understood the physical properties of her materials and their symbolic meaning, intentionally using the materials of religious devotionals, lapis lazuli and gold, to create a painting that achieved that highest of spiritual acts, revelation. Eisler is far from the only critic who understands Martin's abstract paintings in terms that suggest religious devotion. Critic Michael Kimmelman has written that Martin's art is rich in complexity and passion of a sort that seems to pour forth with the intensity of revelation. Hilton Kramer also characterizes the experience of seeing a Martin painting in religious terms, writing that her art has the quality of a religious utterance, almost a form of prayer. Yet another critic, Stuart Preston, describes Martin's paintings, such as the National Gallery's Untitled No. 2, 1981, shown here, as purism in excelsis. The recent retrospective of Martin's work, which closed at the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum in January, met with similarly rapturous reviews. Peter Sheldahl, one of Martin's most perceptive critics, observed that the climb through the Guggenheim's retrospective feels like a secular pilgrimage. "Your heart," he cautions, "may be ambushed by rushes of emotion." It's perhaps no great surprise that Martin herself is often written about in terms that suggest a deity, a desert saint, a sage, a cult figure, an artist's artist. Critics routinely describe their travels to see Martin as a pilgrimage of sorts, especially after she abruptly stopped painting and left New York in 1967, settling a year later on a deserted mesa in Cuba, New Mexico, which you see here. The maps that Martin drew for friends have achieved iconic status among Martin devotees, and the hardship involved in seeing her art once she began painting again in the early 70s was part of the appeal of her work. And there are great stories from journalists who got lost or stranded, sometimes with flooded out arroyos in the mesas of New Mexico, being rescued by Martin in her pickup truck. Martin did little to dissuade critics from this narrative arc, and Sheldahl's characterization of the Guggenheim retrospective as a secular pilgrimage is as much a response to the climb up the Guggenheim ramp as it is an acknowledgement of a recurrent trope in the literature on the artist. Midway through the Guggenheim's retrospective, there was a small 12-inch square painting untitled from 1960. Executed in oil paint on exposed canvas, the painting is divided into 12 sections that are filled with thin black and white lines and bisected by a single horizontal line. Feverish, cross-hatched lines darken the four edges of the canvas, creating a thick boundary. The varying density of Martin's lines gives the painting a sense of visual syncopation amid the black and white palette. At the top and bottom of the canvas, Martin adds more black lines to create a semicircular pattern, which you can see here and there, breaking up the dominance of the grid. A tiny tour de force, the painting demonstrates many of the characteristics that define Martin's best paintings: her astute sense of rhythm, her awareness of texture and reflectance, and her ability to foreground a traditional drawing technique, the crosshatch, as the defining characteristic of a painting. Despite Martin's evident command of her materials and her techniques, there remains a sense of nervous energy, the hint of an unquiet soul. Whenever I look at this painting, I'm reminded of Martin's first dealer, Betty Parsons, who described it as heartstrings pulled out endlessly. Martin's paintings inspire great floods of feeling, and this is exactly as the artist intended, a visceral reaction that leads to a sense of heightened emotion. Martin's best paintings, like Night Sea and Untitled 1960, or The Harvest, shown here, from 1965, elicit this state, and it is this reaction that has propelled her work to such high critical regard. And I should say that if any of you are sitting in the back and thinking this is a terrible slide, Martin's work reproduces very poorly. And so this is actually the best quality image we have, and what you're looking at is a pale yellow field of acrylic paint with a very, very, very finely scored grid in graphite. And if you look very carefully, you can see that there's a border of graphite that just defines the grid along the edges. But if one stops there, at the surface of a shimmering golden grid hovering above a velvety lapis ground, or the haze of deliberately crosshatched marks on exposed canvas, one risks an understanding of Martin's art that, while often revelatory, remains highly circumscribed. What happens then when we leave Martin the desert saint behind with all the ethereal rhetoric that surrounds her paintings and look for Martin the practicing artist? Until recently, the chronology of Martin's work has begun when she, in her words, found the grid in the early 60s. "When I first made a grid," Martin explained, "I happened to be thinking of the innocence of trees, and then this grid came into my mind, and I thought it represented innocence, and so I painted it, and then I was satisfied." This painting here is The Tree at the Museum of Modern Art from 1964. And this is one of the first grid paintings that Martin publicly announced she was satisfied with. Martin's seemingly instantaneous realization of the grid, based upon an inspiration that came to her fully formed, has become part of the mythology surrounding the artist. Many exhibitions, catalogs, and monographs fell in line, beginning their surveys with Martin's grids, or only including a few cursory early works to set the stage for the triumphant advent of the grid, so long a touchstone of modernism. Such was the case for the 92-93 retrospective of Martin's work at the Whitney Museum of American Art, which really introduced Martin's art to a much larger public. Peter Sheldahl, reviewing the exhibition for the Village Voice, remained skeptical of this accepted chronology. In a memorable phrase, Sheldahl declared that this Venus from the Sea effect was anti-informative, concluding that the effect suggests that Martin's mature style was a breeze, when in truth, I suspect without detailed proof, it was an onerous grind. Sheldahl's hypothesis was nothing short of heresy, as Martin spent decades purging her earliest art from her oeuvre. Martin was famous for her annual bonfires during her first years in Taos and later in New York. As she explains, "I painted a lot more paintings than most people did. I used to have a big stack. At the end of the year, I burned them. I burned them all. But here in Taos, I was starving, and I sold a few of them, and I really have suffered because they were not what I want." Martin's regret at the existence of the surviving paintings is palpable, and she often tried to buy them back later in life in order to destroy them. The fact that this painting, untitled circa 1954, survives at the Harwood Museum in Taos, New Mexico, despite Martin's weekly lunches with director Bob Ellis, was a testament to Ellis's considerable fortitude. Martin's conscious role as an editor of her own work will sound familiar to any artists in the audience, and it's by no means unique. She worked hard to shape the criticism of her art and was clear that her early work did not meet her later standards. She also loudly disclaimed the idea of artistic influence, despite evidence to the contrary in her early work. But if we listen carefully to Martin's stories of destruction, an unexpected narrative emerges simultaneously, that of continual reinvention. "The early paintings weren't what I wanted," Martin said. "I wanted really abstract. And so every day I painted, and I got closer and closer to abstract painting, and it took me 20 years. 20 years. Martin's long apprenticeship provided her with a sophisticated set of tools to create paintings of uncommon refinement. Agnes Martin first realized that she wanted to be an artist in 1941 while she was enrolled at Teachers College at Columbia University. Agnes had moved to the United States from Canada a decade earlier and attended high school and college in Bellingham, Washington, before enrolling at Teachers College. While in New York, Martin likely saw exhibitions of art by Arshil Gorky, Adolf Gottlieb, and Miró. "I went to New York and I saw all the paintings in all the museums," she said. "I thought if I could make a living painting, that's what I'd like to do." After graduating, Martin taught until she'd saved enough money to enroll in a master's program at the University of New Mexico in 1947. Far from a provincial outpost, the university had a cosmopolitan art department in the late 40s due to the presence of European refugees from the war and students on the GI Bill, such as the painter Richard Diebenkorn. Martin took classes in Albuquerque and Taos, creating standard issue landscapes, portraits, and still lives. In this watercolor, Martin's watercolors on the left, Martin's use of strong outlines is a nod to John Marin, who painted in New Mexico during the summers of 1929 and 1930. Marin's painting, near Taos number 6, New Mexico, 1930, on the right, shows that Martin and Marin laid claim to nearly the same view of the Taos Mountains. The unexpected congruence between the two watercolors underscores just how squarely Martin's work fit within a traditional representational mode. Upon graduation, Martin taught at UNM and in the local public schools. When Martin returned to Teachers College to earn her master's degree in modern art in 1951 and 52, she spent little time wiping the sand off her shoes. As this drawing, now at the Museum of Modern Art, and we're talking about the image on the left, demonstrates, Martin's shift toward a more abstract idiom was fostered in the classroom. But the specific strategies she took from other artists came from the time she spent looking at art in galleries and museums, much as she had during her previous time in New York. Indeed, in her surviving works on paper from this period, we see Martin looking at Mark Rothko's Multiforms, the sculpture of Alberto Giacometti on the top and Louise Bourgeois on the bottom, and even Stuart Davis's famous egg beater paintings, somewhat surprisingly. Martin's graphic output during this period establishes the breadth of her creative experimentation and her debt to other artists. Martin settled in Taos after graduating from Teachers College, renting a refurbished goat shed to use as a home and studio. And this goat shed is really an apt index of her strained financial circumstances at the time. The expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden, circa 1953 that you see here, is likely one of the first paintings that Martin completed in Taos. The painting acts as a fulcrum between Martin's efforts to understand the legacy of surrealism in New York and her reliance upon the history and culture of New Mexico. Martin's frieze-like use of thinly outlined figures against a flat, neutral ground, interspersed with small abstract forms, demonstrates her knowledge of Miró's painting, The Hunter Catalan Landscape, 1923-1924, which you see at the bottom right. One senses the similarities of form, color, and line in the paintings, and Martin may have seen the Miró retrospective at MoMA during her earlier time in New York in 1941. Mark Rothko's great painting, Slow Swirl at the Edge of the Sea at the top right from 1944, has a clear debt to Miró, and it was equally important to Martin while creating the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. Indeed, much of what Martin learned about surrealism came from Rothko's knowledge of Miró, as this painting demonstrates. If the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden draws from the art that Martin saw in New York City, the efficiency of her linear forms and the pale sandy ground are also reminiscent of ancient Southwestern pictographs. Pictographs could be seen throughout New Mexico at sites like Chaco Canyon and Bandelier National Park in the mid-50s. Similar pictographic forms can be seen in Martin's paintings from the period and function as part of her artistic vocabulary. Martin was not the first artist to draw inspiration from these ancient motifs, however. Adolf Gottlieb's pictograph paintings were exhibited at the Samuel Kutz Gallery in Manhattan in January 1952, when Martin was at Teachers College. For Martin, the encounter must have provoked a profound sense of identification, suggesting that the aesthetic language of the ancient Southwest had as much currency in New York as Miró and Rothko did in Taos. And this is Gottlieb's pictograph from 1948. Martin's ability to incorporate the distinct cultural and aesthetic languages of surrealism, abstract expressionism, and ancient pictographs into a single painting speaks to the fluidity with which she moved between New York and New Mexico. Four surviving works from 1953 through 1954, Autumn Watch, The Bluebird, Dream of Night Sailing, and Untitled, show Martin moving toward more formally geometric compositional structures while continuing to hone her abstract vocabulary. The Bluebird is one of Martin's first extant paintings that places rounded biomorphic shapes into a gridded geometric structure. The painting is divided into three horizontal sections, and Martin places the forms along three vertical axes, 1, 2, 3, creating a grid within the rectangular format of the painting. Notably, Martin's use of the grid developed in tandem with her use of line. In Autumn Watch, which you see here, the grid becomes even more visible through a linear network. On the other hand, there's a sense of modularity in The Bluebird, the feeling that each of those forms could be picked up and moved into a different configuration. This is echoed in works like Untitled and Dream of Night Sailing at the bottom. As these varied works demonstrate, Martin's experimentation was far more expansive than a steady march to the eventuality of the grid. Although Martin is often characterized as a solitary artist today, her years in Taos were punctuated by lively exchanges with other artists. Edward Corbett and Clay Spohn, for example, were both former faculty members at the California School of Fine Arts, and they brought firsthand knowledge of abstract expressionism in San Francisco with them to Taos. Their former colleagues included artists like Richard Diebenkorn, Mark Rothko, and Clifford Still. Corbett and Spohn showed their work in Taos, holding a joint exhibition with Diebenkorn and artist Robert McChesney at La Galleria Escondida. And in this picture, they're seen chatting outside the gallery with the artist Ad Reinhardt during the summer of 1951. And it's always struck me that Reinhardt may not have known much about the desert sun when he wore all black. Martin met Spohn every afternoon for cocktails and conversation at the home of artists B. Mandelman and Louis Riebach, establishing a shared artistic community. This was especially important for Martin and was a pattern she would replicate in New York during the late 50s and early 60s. Mandelman and Riebach also had an art library that was very comprehensive. They had 2,000 volumes in their library, and they subscribed to all the major art publications, all the journals, and all the magazines. So they were getting very current information about the art world at the time, even though they were in the middle of New Mexico. Additionally, Corbett, Mandelman, Riebach, and Spohn functioned as models of successful artists at a time when Martin did not have formal gallery representation in Taos, much less New York or San Francisco. Between the winter of 1955 and the summer of 57, Martin continued to refine her compositions and exhibited her work at the Museum of Modern Art in Albuquerque, the Harwood Foundation in Taos, and at the Art Gallery of the Museum of New Mexico, the state's most prestigious art institutions at the time. She also actively courted the New York gallery owner Betty Parsons, who had gained fame by showing the art of Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko. Although Martin was painting in a refurbished goat shed, her ambition to show her work at the best galleries was clear to all she met. Taos artist Ted Egri, who lived right next door, recalled that Martin was living on beans and painting these Abex paintings. She wanted to get to New York and to the Betty Parsons Gallery. She wanted to get them interested in her and her work. Martin had shown her art to Parsons in 1954 and in 1956. and was ready when Parsons came to Taos during the summer of 1957. As Martin remembered, another boy and I rented a store, an empty store for $9 a month. $9 a month, can you imagine? So we had one-man shows, one after the other. So when Betty Parsons came, I just happened to have a one-man show hanging. Parsons purchased two oil paintings and offered to represent Martin if she moved to Manhattan. Martin's clever salesmanship underscores the ambition, determination, and resourcefulness that characterized her desire to create paintings that could compete with the most advanced art in America. And I also want to point out, when we talk about Martin painting her paintings, to just show you how very many canvases she was creating at this time. I mean, there are just stacks and stacks and stacks of unframed canvases. Martin moved to New York in late fall of 1957 and settled on Coenties Slip, a triangular piece of land at the tip of Lower Manhattan. The slip had been used as a port for sailors and merchants since the 19th century and has a rich literary history, including being cited by Herman Melville in the opening lines of Moby Dick. The unique triangular plan of the slip meant that the old warehouses lining Jeanette Park had views of the East River, the mouth of the Hudson River, and in the distance, the upper bay of the Atlantic Ocean. The best thing about the slip was that it was a triangle, Martin recalled. So it slanted, so all the lofts looked across the triangle to the river. So we were all on the river, even though we were up on the triangle. It was a nice place to live. You could walk along the waterfront. Martin's neighbors included the artists Ellsworth Kelly, Robert Indiana, Lenore Tawney, and Ann Wilson, and Jack Youngerman, as well as the French movie star Delphine Seyrig. Hans Nemes' well-known photograph of the artists on Coenties Slip captures the intimacy and informality of their lives on the slip, which echoes, in many ways, Martin's time in Taos. During her first year on the Coenties Slip, Martin used the tools she developed in Taos to continue to refine her compositions, her palette, and her technique. In an effort to express her own abstract vision, Martin studied the works of other artists, such as Barnett Newman, Ad Reinhardt, and Mark Rothko. A series of paintings from 1957, including Beach, Desert Rain, Window, and Wheat, reveal Martin's sustained effort to understand Reinhardt's compositional strategies, which offered Martin a model of formal clarity and balance in a completely non-objective format. This pairing shows just how closely Martin studied Reinhardt's cruciform formats. In Reinhardt's work, Martin located a precedent for a method of geometric abstraction that crystallized many of her nascent ideas from Taos, the stacked forms of the bluebird, for example, and that was sanctioned by Betty Parsons through her regular shows of Reinhardt's work. Requiring sustained attention and rewarding careful observation, Reinhardt's subtle paintings charted a specific path away from the immediacy and bravado of abstract expressionism that would become important to Martin in the creation of her later grid paintings. Among the artists that Martin met through Parsons was Barnett Newman, whose French Street studio was around the corner from Martin's studio on the slip. As Newman's wife, Anna Lee, remembers, Barney did everything he could for Agnes. First, because she was Betty's friend. He went to parties Betty Parsons gave for Agnes. He brought friends. He talked to other people about her work. And right from the beginning, he hung all her shows. Barney had a terrific eye for new young talent, and he recognized Agnes's possibilities. If Newman's efforts on Martin's behalf were somewhat self-interested, as Parsons was also his dealer, they had a considerable impact on Martin's career. Newman's support of Martin's work gave her paintings legitimacy within the New York scene and created interest in her first exhibitions. Martin's attention to Newman's painting is most visible in Untitled 1957 by Martin on the left. On the right is a Newman painting. Martin's painting measures 34 inches square, and it's executed in oil paint over an artist-applied priming on a finely woven cotton duck support. The strip of white paint in the center of the painting is a direct homage to Newman's Zips, seen here. That's one of Newman's zips. The zips were a compositional device that Newman used to unite rather than divide the space of the canvas. Additionally, the symmetry, variable brushwork, and direct composition of Untitled are reminiscent of Newman's work, especially One Mint 4, 1949, shown here. However, Martin's use of triangular rather than rectangular forms differentiates Untitled 1957 from Newman's work at the time. Martin, as we know, looked at Rothko's multiforms during her time in New York in 1951-52, and she returns to Rothko's work once again at the end of the 50s. This is the spring from 1958, and in it, Martin's composition consists of two large, pale green rectangular forms bordered by cream paint, which are set against a flat field of taupe and separated by three purple horizontal bands. The painting, interestingly, is analogous not with Rothko's own work in 1958, but with his earlier work, and specifically number 7 or number 11, Untitled 1949, a great early Rothko that hangs at the National Gallery now. Number 7 or number 11, Untitled, was shown at the Betty Parsons Gallery in 1950 and mentioned in Art Digest, a magazine, the same year. And it provides a model for Martin's formal structure in the spring. By breaking the square composition into thirds through the use of rectangular forms, with borders on either side and at the top and bottom, Martin creates a balanced composition. But importantly, it manages to feel flat and somewhat mechanical without the movement or depth we see in the painting on the right. While Rothko's forms advance and recede in the viewer's eye, creating Rothko's famous hovering fields of color, Martin's forms feel fixed in place. Martin's readings and her misreadings of Rothko are instructive, as they lay bare her ability to critically evaluate Rothko's strategies and techniques in the service of her own aesthetic vision. Martin showed the spring at her first long-awaited one-woman exhibition at Betty Parsons Section 11 Gallery in December of 1958, the exhibition that Newman hung. Hanging on the wall at Section 11, the spring marks a crucial transitional moment in Martin's career, her debut in the New York art world, and the moment at which Martin's long apprenticeship came to an end. The spring is not one of Martin's fully mature grid paintings, though it does begin to meet Martin's standard of complete non-objectivity, as the artist explained later in life. I painted for 20 years without painting a painting that I liked. I never painted a painting I liked until I got to New York, and they were completely non-objective, and then I liked them. When I started out painting, I painted everything, from landscapes and Indians to flowers and everything. I even taught portrait painting at the University of New Mexico. Gradually, over 20 years, my work became more and more abstract. It was a process. In this revealing statement, Martin departs from her famous reliance upon inspiration to acknowledge the lengthy development of abstraction in her work. Martin's abstract paintings were hard won, and her process was full of nonlinear patterns of development, crucial moments of transition, and periods of aesthetic discernment. Martin's movement toward abstraction was also punctuated by moments of connection with other artists on the slip, as with Ellsworth Kelly, shown here. Also one of Parsons' artists, Kelly moved to Quenty's slip in July 1956. And there's a story that Martin actually made Ellsworth blueberry muffins for breakfast every day for a year and a half. Kelly had arrived in New York 2 years earlier after spending 6 years in Paris. And his lack of knowledge of contemporary movements in American art allowed him to move forward with his investigations of shape, line, and color without much recourse to the legacy of abstract expressionism. Coenti's slip for Kelly represented a world apart, consciously leaving behind the heritage of Willem de Kooning and Jackson Pollock. Kelly's relative autonomy and the freshness of his flat, hard-edged paintings, seen in this slide, you can see Kelly there, you can see another right down there. So Kelly's relative autonomy and the freshness of his flat-hard-edged paintings provided an entirely new model for Martin, and one that came right at the right moment. The desire to move beyond the heritage of de Kooning and Pollock is also evident in his series of wooden constructions that Martin made in 1958. These objects are among the most unexpected and intriguing works of her early career. The constructions vary considerably in size, from Kali on the left, which is 11 inches square, to the much larger The Laws, which is nearly 8 feet tall on the right. And to get a sense of scale, The Laws can be seen here on the far right wall of the fiber artist Lenore Tawney's studio. Like many artists on the slip, Martin turned to assemblage because found materials offered an efficient and certainly an inexpensive alternative to large-scale abstract expressionist painting. Joining artists like Robert Indiana, who recalled that assemblage was in the air, Martin scavenged the docks, using discarded steel bolts to create works of art. For Martin, assemblage provided a means to test her evolving compositional ideas through different media, exploring issues of color, depth, form, scale, texture, and repetition. In fact, Martin's development of the grid in a painted format owes as much to her sculptural work as to her painting. This is especially the case with regard to Kali, seen here. Martin drove 37 black or white painted wooden boat spikes into 7 attached pieces of wood. Martin sold both Kali and The Laws to Lenore Tawney. A photograph of Tawney in her Spring Street studio shows the artist working at a large desk. To the right, we see Kali, rather surprisingly hanging on the wall, rather than set on a table, as it has been published in nearly every book or catalog that I've seen to date. Hung on the wall and protruding 4 inches, Kali suddenly appears to be a relief, rather than a sculpture. Just below Kali, Tawney has hung a 12-inch square painting by Martin titled Homage to Greece, right here, which is signed and dated 1959 on the verso. Oh, sorry, hold on. There we go. The painting consists of 16 3-inch squares of canvas painted cream, which has been affixed in 4 rows of overlapping sections to a used wooden board. Martin then hammered 21 nails into the surface of the work in the shape of an arc. Nearly equivalent in size, the two works are both composed of supports that are pieced together, sections of wood or squares of canvas, into which Martin inserted round spikes or nails. Tawney's installation encapsulates Martin's distillation of the three-dimensional form of relief into the shallower form of a painting. Given these works, it can be argued that ultimately, Martin does not turn away from assemblage so much as refine the underlying strategies and apply them to her painted formats. Martin made the connection between her later grid paintings and the tactile nature of Homage to Greece explicit in a conversation with the artist Ann Wilson. Referring to the lines of her grid paintings, Martin explained, "I began the lines in pigment. I cut up squares of canvas and pasted them on small rectangular canvas. They're not exact squares. They were painted white. Then I nailed down nails in a slight arch line near the top. I called it Homage to Ancient Greece, just at the edge of the arch across the top. The lines began as points in space." Martin's remark that the lines began as points in space confirms the importance of her sculptural work to her painting, and she specifically cites Homage to Greece as the moment in which her line shifted from the robustly material presence, shiny silver tacking nails, these are all shiny silver tacking nails, to the more subtle media of pigment and sparkling graphite from her grids. And this is a detail from Play 2, 1966, which is now at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It would be tempting at this juncture to move swiftly towards Martin's grid paintings, leaving her tactile forms in favor of an increasingly graphic aesthetic. Homage to Greece appears to point the way. In The Islands 1961, for example, Martin rules a subtle graphite grid on exposed canvas, over which she places a series of small paired marks in cream-colored oil paint, which create a smaller grid pattern. The graphite grid, placed under the painted marks, adds depth to the painting, while the thick, shiny dashes of cream-colored oil paint provide a sharp contrast to the soft nap of the exposed canvas. Martin's use of a thin, cream-colored border edged in graphite holds the composition together and is punctuated by the presence of small graphite registration marks at the edge of the canvas support. These seemingly insignificant details, when taken together, provide the visual stimuli that engender great rushes of emotions. You can well understand how Peter Plangens could recently write, with reference to the grids of the Guggenheim, "Plato wouldn't have believed his eyes." But Martin's evolution in the late 50s and early 60s can't be wrapped up so neatly, as she continued to work on ideas and concepts over time and across various media. In Earth 2 from 1959 on your left, shows Martin working with the geometric arrangement of monochromatic rectangles, while she tests the same compositional theories using a square format in circles in Buds from 1959 on the right. Surprisingly, we still see vestiges of representational objects in Martin's work of the period, as in the book 1959 on the left and Dominoes 1960 on the right. Measuring 36 by 12 inches, Dominoes shows Martin borrowing both her composition and her subject matter from an object of pop culture, the domino. While this reminds us of Martin's active engagement with the world around her, something we often forget, her composition also resembles Robert Indiana's wooden sculptures and his monumental paintings of circles from 1959. In an essay on Indiana, curator Barbara Haskell notes, several months into the series, Indiana experienced a moment of doubt when he saw the latest work of Agnes Martin, which utilized a similar modular layout of geometric shapes. This begins to make it rather hard that we should be using the same motif, Indiana wrote in his journal. Unfortunate for me, not for her. Indiana's journal entry is startling in its acknowledgement of the similarity between his work and Martin's, but it's made all the more so by the fact that he ceded priority to Martin, a rare occurrence for a female artist in the late 50s and early 60s in New York. This creative exchange demonstrates that Martin had developed a strong enough aesthetic voice that her motif was recognized as her own, an apt indicator of her newfound artistic maturity. And Dominoes is a curious piece within Martin's larger body of work, not least because it reminds us that Martin used representational subject matter until 1960, the same year that she created a full-scale grid painting, White Flower. This, of course, goes against the teleological models of progress that Martin implies of painting and burning for 20 years until she arrived at a non-objective painting she liked. But as we've seen this afternoon, Martin was far more innovative in her early work than has previously been assumed, and she relied on specific networks of artists while refining her own form of abstraction. If the creation of Dominoes and White Flower in the same year forecloses the possibility of a tidy march to the eventuality of the grid within Martin's oeuvre, it also opens up a far more productive path, that of a rigorous pursuit of abstraction fueled by continual experimentation. Perhaps the idea of Martin suddenly becoming a mature artist upon the advent of her grid paintings is as much a folly as the idea of Martin as a saint. She was, after all, 48 years old in 1960, and she'd been painting for two decades. And if we look at Martin's art rather than the narratives that surround it, we understand that the success of her work lies in her sophisticated manipulation of materials and techniques to create paintings of rare sensitivity. When we consider the full sweep of Martin's artistic development, the intellectual and material decisions that define her grid paintings emerge not as momentary inspirations, but as carefully considered, thoroughly tested aesthetic choices. The fact that Martin's best paintings, like Night Sea, call forth such forceful emotions in viewers is not a miracle, religious or otherwise. It's a testament to Martin's considerable abilities. Does anyone have any questions? Yes, hi.
Were her lines hand-drawn?
Yes, yes, they were all hand-drawn. And she often would use a string to rule the graphite lines, and sometimes she would use a ruler. And as you know, especially on larger paintings like this, there's a wooden structure underneath the canvas. This might be old hat for some of you, but there's sort of four pieces of wood that form a square, and then often there are crossbars in between, sometimes in a cruciform format. The larger the painting gets, the more elaborate they get. And the canvas is nailed, usually on the sides, but sometimes on the back, to hold that canvas around that wooden structure. And what that means is that you get a really moving, responsive support with the canvas. And when you think about Martin's grid paintings that are usually 6x6, later in life she moved to 5x5 feet, but they're 6x6, so when you're drawing a line across a support that's got some give and some movement in it, you know, what naturally happens is that your hand goes down, right? The canvas moves, you think you're doing a straight line, and it ends up totally bowed. And so Martin would move section by section across the work. And I think it's also really interesting and important that Martin ultimately settled on canvas. You know, in some of her early works, like Homage to Greece, she's wrapping that canvas around a board, which is a much firmer support. She also uses paperboard. And in works like, paperboard is like foam core, so it's a hard support, but very lightweight. And in works like Dominoes, I don't know if you can see it from the back, but you see how there's kind of this little area, this lighter area right there where you think something's wrong with the slide. That's actually where Martin laid paper, two different pieces of paper, that's where they join, and then she laid them onto canvas. So she's definitely testing out during her early work a number of supports to find the support that she really felt best elucidated her abstract vision. And that handmade quality and the moving responsive support on the canvas is a very clear aesthetic choice on her part. Yes?
I don't know much about the biography, but was there any relationship or contact between Georgia O'Keeffe and
Yes, so Georgia O'Keeffe lived in New Mexico. Georgia O'Keeffe and Martin had sort of a similar, you can't say bicoastal because New Mexico's landlocked, but they both had time in New York and then time in New Mexico. And O'Keeffe is really important for Martin because she was one of the few, you know, successful artists, female artists at the time, who'd left New York. And I think it's really important to think about O'Keeffe as a model as an artist who left New York and really was still able to build her critical reputation from an outpost. And I think it's important to also think about the fact that when she was in New York, Martin was one of a number of artists who were trying to make it. It's a very dense population of artists in New York, and New Mexico has a lot of artists as well. But Martin was able to become this sage in the desert. She really built up this persona for herself, modeled a lot on O'Keeffe. I mean, if you look at O'Keeffe's portraits and the photographs of O'Keeffe, she's definitely performing a role, right? And I think it's to some degree Martin's doing a similar thing. She understood the marketing potential of being a desert saint in New Mexico. Now, more directly to your question, yes, Martin did meet Georgia O'Keeffe. In the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe, there's great correspondence between them where Martin is writing to O'Keeffe, and she really, really, really wanted O'Keeffe to travel around the world on a freighter with her, which never came to pass, and I think Martin took someone else on a freighter around the world. Martin traveled really extensively, which is not often recorded in the literature. But I think it's just this great idea of these two iconic female artists on a freighter in the middle of the Indian Sea or whatever. But there's also another famous story about Martin and O'Keeffe where Martin went to see O'Keeffe. And And she was so exhausted. And she was mad at O'Keefe because O'Keefe kept flirting with the guy that Martin brought with her. Even though Martin was a lesbian, that still bothered her. And so she was mad about that. And then she said that seeing O'Keefe was so exhausting that she had to go lay down afterwards. Yes, hi.
Hi. Was graphite and gold leaf on canvas, what are the challenges going forward in terms of conservation? It just seems to me that they're somewhat fleeting. And you see that in the Blue Sea painting.
Yeah, in the Night Sea painting. You know, it's really interesting. The details from the Night Sea painting are courtesy of Paula De Cristofaro at SF MoMA. She's one of their leading conservators of modern art. And Night Sea has really been the subject of a lot of questions for a long time. Let me see if I can get myself back there quickly enough. Because it's a, and I have to say, it is a absolutely stunning painting in person. It looks totally boring and not worth, you know, the money here. But it's really a stunning painting. And these details are from Paula, and they really do serve to do well. And so there's a lot of question about the application of the gold leaf. For a long time, I wondered whether it was a crayon or whether it was some sort of pen. You know, you see those gold pens you write invitations with, things like that. But we don't think so. Paula actually thinks that it's burnished, which is a very old-fashioned method. And what's interesting is that these lines, they're actually scored. You know, and the scoring goes vertical, but it also goes horizontally, as you see here. So there's gold leaf, but there's also a little bit of evidence of yellow and orange crayon. So it's a very, very complicated painting, and we're hoping to look at it under a microscope soon to get a little more clarity. But the gold leaf to my eye has faded. You can see the shimmering reflectance here and here, but you lose it up here. So gold leaf, I think, is a pretty stable medium. Is that right, Harry? Sort of.
No.
Yeah. I think it does depend what it's on, and I think it also really, there's a whole, especially if you look at Renaissance painting manuals and you talk to a conservator of Renaissance painting, or even earlier paintings, or Italian paintings, there's a whole process by which you burnish gold leaf. Like, it's not slapdash. You don't just put it on. You have to prepare things appropriately. You've got to put the right color underneath it. You've got to get the right sort of tackiness to get the gold leaf to adhere. You've got to use specific tools to rub it on and then brush it off. And it comes usually in little packets. So you do need to follow those procedures, otherwise it won't work. The other thing I can tell you, if we can get back to one of my installation images, you see that painting there in the center? This is Friendship. The whole thing is done in gold leaf. And this was one of the paintings that when I saw the exhibition at the Guggenheim, it was just mobbed. I mean, people could not get enough of this painting. Everyone was taking their selfies and their Instagram whatevers. And this painting just underwent a thorough conservation job, or treatment, I should say. And so one of the reasons that it looks so good is because of that conservation. Now, the graphite on canvas for Martin seems to have been, you can't really see it here, seems to have been fairly stable, as far as I know. There are notes in the literature from conservators who've worked on her paintings all the time that they'd see smudges on the edges of her paintings. So she often moved her paintings by herself. That's why they're 6x6, so she could physically move them in her studio. And some of those smudge marks were taken off later by the gallery, but they didn't bother her at the time. And those are smudge marks along the edges, not along the actual center of the works. Yes, hi, in the center, and then I'll come to you. Great question. She never really answered that question. A lot of people asked. She always equivocated. Her friend Ed Reinhardt had died, and they were very close friends at the time. Her loft was turned down, and she makes some sort of statements here and there about the fact that she was sort of, I'm not sure quite how to say it, but she was becoming successful as an artist, and she was having trouble reconciling that with her own artistic practice. So nobody really knows. She took off in a camper, and she drove around the country. She went to Canada. She went all over the place. Lenore Tawney came and was with her for a little bit, but then that was it. She tells a story that she saw a vision of an adobe brick, and ended up on a mesa in Cuba, New Mexico. And for those of you who haven't been to Cuba, Cuba is absolutely tiny. And then from Cuba, you have to drive up onto this mesa that is absolutely deserted. There was no electricity, no running water when Martin got there. She built all of these, her studio and her home and some outbuildings all by herself. And another fact that's not as well known, Martin had actually built a prior house when she was working at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. So she had laid all of that adobe brick. Very cleverly, she conscripted her students at the University of New Mexico to come help her build her house, which I did not do as a professor at the University of New Mexico. But so this idea of this vision of an adobe brick, you know, it's somewhat poetic, but it also, she really did lay all those adobe bricks. And then later on, she began to work in Galisteo after she moved out of Cuba into a suburb of Santa Fe, and she built that house as well. The other way to answer your question is that Nancy Princenthal's recent biography of Martin revealed in greater detail than before that Martin did suffer from mental illness. And so, you know, whether I haven't actually done a chronology to know when Martin had her periods of illness and if that affected her working patterns or not, or when she was working or when she wasn't. But there's possibility there. And yes, you had a question. Okay, so I think the question is that this visitor was struck by the fact that Robert Indiana and Martin were both creating these works with circles in 1959 and 1960. And Robert Indiana ends up in his long career of having many more circles in his work, and Martin really abandons the circular format. And so why would Indiana cede priority to Martin? And I don't know the answer to that. But I can tell you that I had lunch in New Mexico last week with a friend of Martin's who is a sculptor, who spent lots and lots of time with her in her later years. And I asked about the circle, because I keep wondering about it. And she said that Martin had told her that the circle was too expanding. It was too expansive of a form, and that she preferred not to use it as a result. Yes.
Most of the work you show part of her time was up to 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
She lived until 2004.
Yes.
So what did she do for the remainder?
Yeah, great question. I don't have a lot of images of that. I should have had more. Let's go. So Martin created these really beautiful grid paintings up until she left New York. And then she left New York, she drove around, et cetera, and then she started back working with a series of prints called On a Clear Day that are very, very minimalist prints. And then from there, she started working, she began painting again, and she began painting, this is early work, she began painting bands of color, pale bands of color in horizontal formats. And then eventually in the 80s, she began to do these really beautiful series of paler white and gray works. And some of them have ink that are rubbed onto the surface in very textured formats and really beautiful. And then she did some darker paintings in these sumptuous blue grays. And you can see a little here. And towards the end of her life, she actually ended up doing some more abstract compositions that look more, at the very, very end of her life, that look more like her early work. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.